Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the Defence Ministry distances itself from the SANDF chief's remarks regarding Iran. South African business confidence climbs, driven by autos, manufacturing and precious metals. Coastal communities win big as the High Court orders Total Energies to redo flawed drilling plans. And from patient numbers to patient outcomes, could value-based healthcare fix the country's healthcare crisis? It's Friday, the 15th of August. And let's start the program with this. South Africa's Ministry of Defence and Military Veterans is moving swiftly to distance itself from controversial comments reportedly made by SANDF Chief General Rudzani Mapanya during a visit to Iran. According to the ministry, foreign policy is the sole domain of the President and the Department of International Relations, not the Defence Force. The clarification comes after reports suggested the general expressed solidarity with Iran in a way that could have diplomatic repercussions. The ministry now says it will engage with him. Joining us is Onega Kwakwa, who speaks for the Ministry of Defence and Military Veterans. A very warm welcome to you and thank you. So what key questions then does the ministry have for the general?
Good day, Jeremy, and good day to the listeners. Let me just indicate that the meeting has already taken place last night. And the ministers were clear in our statement that the statements or the utterances of the chief were very unfortunate. The minister wanted to understand what really had informed the chief to utter foreign policy statements and even political statements are not in the purview of the Department of Defense. And the chief and the minister, they engaged, and we might not be able to divulge, you know, what were the decisions that we arrived at that meeting, because as you might have heard, the president's spokesperson has also indicated that the president will engage with the chief, and because the president is the one who appoints the chief, who will be guided by the presidency.
Let me ask you, though, if your minister was satisfied with the responses that he received.
I might not be. I don't want us to get into the engagements now. I think we are going to be, ahead of ourselves. Let's allow the president to engage, and then we're going to be able to talk some more in terms of the conversation between the minister and the chief, and what was the minister's thinking, and what will be the course of action moving forward.
When is that meeting with the president going to take place? Would you have any indication?
I don't have any indication, but as you might have heard yesterday, the spokesperson for the ministry, for the presidency, said that it will be sometime next week, and when he was engaging on the diary of the president. But we will wait and hear from them.
On the surface, this does suggest a breakdown in discipline or adherence to protocol at the very highest levels of the SANDF.
I don't know whether this isolated story, I don't take this light, I understand. I'm saying this particular incident, he cannot therefore just paint a brush of a department that doesn't follow protocol. I mean, the chief requested the mandate from the minister to travel. The minister did approve, because we understand that we do have bilateral relations with Iran, like we have with many other states. We enjoy the working bilateral relations defense bilateral relations with Iran since 1996, when we first, you know, started to engage with them after our democracy, and later the MOU that we signed with Iran in 2016. And we've been engaging with Iran. So it's not really breaking of protocol for us to meet with the Iranian state. But what we are really taking exception, and we're very unequivocal as a ministry, is that the chief statements were unfortunate, and there will be a course of action. But as to what will be done, will be guided by the president.
Unfortunate is one word, but the ministry must be concerned about the potential diplomatic fallout from these reported statements. They could be hugely damaging.
Yes, unfortunately, it's a very big statement that we are making. We are aware of what this potentially can, and within the current geopolitics, what it means for us as a country. That is why the minister did not even, you know, miss a day. Upon his return, a minister with his busy schedule, and also preparing for the dialogue yesterday, she had to make sure that she meets with the chief to get an understanding of his thinking when he was uttering political and foreign policy statements. But we will not, you know, beyond the engagement until we get a guidance from the president. You might have also heard the tone of the presidency yesterday through its spokesperson, that indeed this is actually in the words of the presidency, they say the trip is ill-advised, and that is something that we can always engage. But the tone of the presidency and the minister is that of being very concerned of what the utterances could, you know, potentially bring to us as a country diplomatically.
Anika, I imagine this incident must prompt a review on how SANDF leaders are briefed before any international engagement.
We have a very robust briefing, both with minister and with the chief and other senior military officials. When they go abroad, actually, they leave with a file, a pack that will then engage on what are the historical relations that we enjoy with that particular country or we have, and what has been, you know, our engagement since, you know, the time we started engaging post 1994, of course, even pre, for some of the states, and then what then if we already do have maybe an MOU or cooperation of some sort that is signed, then how do you continue to service that? So we take them through a very robust brief. So that is why the statements, when they came, the utterances by the chief, they also shocked us as a ministry, because we do not expect the chief to really, you know, enter into that terrain. And we are very clear when we are saying that the statements were unfortunate, but we are very thorough when we have got chiefs or senior military personnel, even the minister itself, when they go to represent the country internationally.
It suggests to me that briefing document wasn't read and that the general simply went rogue.
I was not in the meeting, Jeremy, and probably maybe that was what was also discussed with the minister yesterday. So I don't know whether the chief went through, and because when you are in engagement, you probably would know that you can have follow-up questions, you can have, you know, follow-up engagements after you go through an official, you know, statement. So I don't know what really transpired, you know, word by word, item by item, but I can assure you that the chief, through our Defense International Unit, a unit that is dedicated to advise both the minister and the chief and other military personnel on issues of, you know, foreign defense policy, including how we engage with other states. So we're very clear in terms of how we're organized, but I don't want to really say what is it that the chief was thinking when he went into the domain, but that's what we are currently engaging.
Did the president have any knowledge of the general's visit to Iran, or was this simply enabled by your minister without informing the presidency?
As you might know, it's Section 200 the certain powers that the president enjoys with regard to how he relates with defense, but also there are certain, you know, delegations that the minister would have on how she relates with the South African National Defense Force. So the president, as you probably might have heard through the spokesperson's briefing yesterday, is that the president did not sanction the trip, neither did he know about the chief's visit to Iran. But the minister approved the trip, very much aware of our engagements with Iran historically and currently, and how we keep on servicing the memorandum of understanding. That's something that we do well as defense. We don't just have MOU sitting, you know, in cupboards and gathering dust. We make sure that we service MOUs that we have with different states or defense forces.
But it's still odd, is it not, that the presidency was unaware of this visit?
Yes, I didn't know that the president was not aware until the spokesperson of the president indicated yesterday. But the trip was approved, and the minister has the powers to approve the chief's trips, like she would have the powers to approve the Secretary of Defense, which is the DG in our case.
Just a quick one. Will the minister support a suspension of the general while this is being investigated further by the presidency?
The minister will support whatever decision that the president would take.
Thank you very much indeed. Onika Kwakwa, who speaks for the Ministry of Defence and Military Veterans.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you might have seen that South Africa's business confidence has shown remarkable recovery, the SACI Business Confidence Index leaping from 113.2 in June to 116.7 in July, driven, I understand, by surging vehicle sales, better manufacturing output, and rising precious metals prices. But is this positive momentum being tempered by looming uncertainty? What am I talking about? Well, the US's newly imposed 30% tariff on South African exports, that could threaten to derail growth. And SACI is warning of what it terms unintended and austere consequences for the economy and trade relations. Those are words to live by. I'm in conversation now with Advocate Mtoqulu, who is president of SACI, and I want to discuss what this all means for business and the road ahead. So, Advocate, a very warm welcome to you. That uptick in BCI is encouraging, but I guess the question is, how sustainable is the sentiment, particularly with a major export partner slapping us with those hefty tariffs, as I've just outlined?
Looked a very good point to start off, because effectively the uptick that we are recording is mainly from our financial indicators, which effectively, like you've just summarized them, driven by share price, precious metal prices, and obviously lower inflation. But it doesn't talk to the core of the economy, which we are still worried, because manufacturing and other indicators are showing that they're either neutral or negative. But furthermore, when you also get into the global terrain in terms of the pressure that we are going to have with tariffs, it means that South Africa's economy actually needs to perform and needs to be competitive, so that we are able to respond to the and protect the U.S. account, but also be able to be competitive globally beyond the 13% of global trade that is controlled by the U.S. There's 87% that we must be participating in, which means that the wake-up call, not only to protect the U.S., but also to understand that we must be agile and competitive in this new era.
Let's talk a little bit about competitiveness in just a moment, but you've warned of, and I quote, unintended and austere consequences. What do you think those are going to look like in terms of job losses, investment pullback, and economic slowdown unless we start moving quickly?
Yes, absolutely. We need to really be sensitive to, you know, the pressure that Washington is placing on us, because the U.S. remains not only a trading partner, but one of the biggest investors in South Africa. It's also a very influential economy on other economies that we might want to do a deal with on the side. So effectively, if you lose the source, which is the U.S. account, you inadvertently will end up struggling to even convince other countries that will have a different deal with the U.S. So effectively, the U.S. may lean particular on a particular country, for instance, to say, you know, if you continue to associate with South Africa, you know, you'll run into trouble. So we are saying protect the U.S. not only because it's a big trading partner on the numbers, but it's also an influential market, because it can influence any other places. If you lose or beyond the wrong side of that influence, it means that our account of global trade shrinks. no more investment pools, no more trade opportunities, and obviously a devastating impact on the domestic economy, primarily jobs. So the US is important as a single market, but also important because it's influential on any other market that you might want to trade with if you think you can help, if you think you can replace it.
Which begs the question then, how effective do you think government initiatives are, like this new export support desk, for instance? Are we moving quick enough to counter against the warning that you've made?
Well, our view is that there is credibility in what has become the intervention initially announced by the ministers and then cabinet endorsing it. So it's a good move because it demonstrates that we really do seem to want to engage with the US and reset the relationships. What I think we need to start doing now, especially to build confidence domestically, is to start maybe reflecting on who are the technical people who are actually negotiating, because we are still none the wiser whether it left to the ministry, is it left to the presidency, or do we really have sharp business people behind this who are able to say this is actually how an economy can function. So we think that the pronouncements are encouraging, but I think for us to be really agile and be demonstrative of productivity, we need to be able to also expand who are the leaders who's really negotiating this deal and what do we actually think will come out of it. So pronouncements aside, we need to get to the meat and the substance of the transaction and the structuring of this new relationship.
Am I hearing you correctly when you're suggesting that perhaps business needs to step up and that government needs to step out the way?
So effectively, and I think the Ministry of DECO primarily makes a very good point to say ambassadors and ministers don't negotiate trade deals. Yet, if you see the public optics, it is only the ministers who are getting the coverage. So effectively, we are saying the policy has gone out on what we intend to do. But have you been able to properly align? For instance, if you say auto, agri, and the likes are going to be primarily affected, where are the commercial farmers in really driving the conversation and providing technical expertise to the policy statement that the ministry has made? So our call is that government has already made a policy pronouncement. Let us get the business people to give the technical support and elevate and demonstrate to South Africans that indeed a lot of effort is going in here. And obviously, eventually, a trade deal must be structured by business people.
Let me also suggest to you that it doesn't matter who's sitting around the negotiating table. Politically, it would seem we are still on the wrong side of the United States and the current administration, given our association with Russia and Iran, for instance.
Yeah, look, those are very big non-trade matters, but more geopolitical. And I think, unfortunately, South Africa has taken a particular international foreign policy that leans to that. I mean, Iran and Russia, not only do we have bilaterals, but remember, we also now sit with them in BRICS. So those are things that need to be properly managed, and obviously we leave that to the presidency. But it's something that's leaning on badly on us. It does seem like it. But unfortunately, you know, when you associate with BRICS, you need to be able to elevate that conversation to demonstrate exactly why we are part of it. You know, it's the strategic thing, because remember, Moscow and Washington are not actually sworn enemies currently. There is a relationship between the two presidents, but are we able to actually get into that relationship and explain to Washington on why we associate with Moscow, similarly to with them doing the same thing? So it is a very big political discussion, but we must not just brush over it. If we want to stay in these relationships, we must demonstrate why we are there and obviously then face the consequences accordingly.
But as things stand at the moment, those two issues, the trade and geopolitics, are inextricably linked together, and it's going to be difficult for South Africa to choose a side.
It's going to be impossible. And you are right, they are extremely linked. So it's proper geopolitics, geoeconomics. And unfortunately, you know, it's a very harsh world when you multilateralism. And as I said to you, we need to be able to demonstrate why we associate with certain countries. And I think there is some value if you talk about the political cooperation. And then it means that you must go and convince Washington why it's important for us to stay with Moscow, in the same way that Washington does have a line to Moscow currently. So there is substance into the discussion. I think we must not just talk through them. It's important that President Trump understands it. And I think it's the job of Pretoria to make that clear to him.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Advocate Mthoxolo, who is president of the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this is a follow-up to a story that we covered in some detail last week or the week before. A major victory now for environmental rights and coastal communities. The Western Cape High Court has halted a controversial offshore oil and gas drilling project along the country's southwest coast. Now, the court set aside government's approval for the Block 567 drilling plan, originally granted to Total Energies and now earmarked for transfer to Shell, after finding serious flaws in how environmental and social risks were assessed. The ruling follows a serious challenge from the NGOs The Green Connection and Natural Justice and orders new studies, greater transparency and full public participation before any decision can be reconsidered. I want to talk to Shahil Singh, who is a legal advisor at The Green Connection. So, Shahil, the ruling itself in practical terms, what does it mean? Is the project effectively dead or just delayed?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. So, if we look at the project, what it means is that it's not necessarily dead. So, the decision has been referred back to the minister and to the department to reconsider everything, and the decision of the department and minister to set aside our internal appeal has been set aside. So they've got to reconsider everything on a fresh basis, but the court has set guidelines that the department must take into consideration when they make the new decision. So the project starts afresh, and it could potentially still happen again, but for now it is a victory.
What is your understanding when the court says greater transparency is needed in the process?
So that really refers to public participation, which is at the heart of what the whole submission was about. And when they say greater transparency, what they mean is that the public needs to be more involved in the entire process, especially when it affects their lives in terms of small-scale fishes in coastal communities. For instance, one part of the authorization made provision for the oil spill blowout plan to only be released after the project was approved. Now, that means that the public didn't have an opportunity to scrutinize what would be done in the event of an emergency or a blowout. So if they don't have that information available to them on hand, there's no way for them to actually participate properly in this project. So it refers to things like those in completely involving the public and being transparent about what they're doing and how they're going to do it and how they would react in emergencies.
Do you have a view on why the critical oil spill contingency plans or blowout plans were kept from the public until after authorization?
I mean, at this point, it's quite difficult to say. But I mean, if you look at things on face value, at the very least, it's most likely because it refers to something that's quite dangerous. And, you know, it's difficult to quantify. And so they wanted the project to move ahead and kind of figure out this as an afterthought, when it really has to be the way around, because this is something that could severely impact coastal communities and not just within our waters. For instance, in terms of international law, we have an obligation to make sure that oil spills don't affect neighboring countries. But according to the modeling, if there was an oil spill, there's a very likely possibility that oil could end up in the waters of Namibia as well and affect communities there and industries there, which wasn't properly taken into account.
We know that Shell has a long history of controversial projects. Is there concern that they might try to push ahead regardless of this ruling?
Well, we would certainly hope not. I mean, because they have to operate within the letter of the law. So the court has made its ruling and has stopped the project for now. So if they had to move ahead, they would possibly be in contempt of court, and that could possibly be a criminal offense. So we're hoping that they will abide by the court's ruling, and I mean, they have to. They don't have a choice in the matter.
How confident, Shahil Singh, are you that the Department of Minerals and Petroleum is going to conduct a truly independent reassessment this time around?
At this point, confidence levels aren't particularly high, because if they were truly acting as transparent as they should have, acting within the operation, within the guidelines of the law, we wouldn't be in this place. We wouldn't have had to have a long court battle at the High Court. And yet that did happen. So I think that confidence levels are not very high that they're going to do what they need to do. And that's why it's gotten to the point where the court has had to provide direction to them on what actually needs to be done. And this is something that should have been done in the first place. It shouldn't have to get to this.
So if those levels of confidence are low, how will your organization and others monitor the next phase to ensure that public participation is a little more meaningful and not just a tick box exercise?
So in the past, that's exactly what's happened. It's been a tick box exercise. So as the Green Connection, we have vast community networks and people that could potentially be impacted by these projects. So one thing that we do is we constantly check in with the communities and check in that if anyone is checking up on them, if anyone's including them in the decision-making process. And this is how we keep our ear to the ground to find out what's really happening to the people who would be most affected by these kinds of projects.
We know that offshore oil and gas is sold as a real economic opportunity. How do you counter that argument when livelihoods are at stake? How do you find a judicious balance?
So that's usually the argument that's put forward in terms of any kind of fossil fuel development. And you really need to look at what's going on in the communities. If you actually ask people their views on it, you'll find out that it's not necessarily that people are in favor of fossil fuel developments. It's just that that's the direction South Africa has traditionally been in, you know, whether it's coal or whatever fossil fuels we're talking about. And in the past, they've seen that these industries have the potential to create some jobs. And South Africa hasn't historically been very big on clean, renewable energy. But the thing is, even those developments of clean renewable energy, whether it's solar farms, wind farms, hydroelectric developments, also create economic prosperity. They create job opportunities. People need to maintain those developments. And we just need to get that message out there to people. And really, that's at the heart of why some people believe in the economic prosperity of oil and gas. But that's not the case. Most of the job opportunities go to outside companies, well, consultants who hire people who aren't from the areas. So the economic prosperity is very minimal.
Shahil Singh, thank you very much indeed. Legal advisor at the Green Connection.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I think it's fair to say that South Africa's private healthcare system is stuck in a high-cost, low-impact trap. It often rewards doctors and hospitals for the number of services they deliver rather than whether patients actually get any better. And that is a little bit of an indictment. Well, PPO Serve's value care team model claims to flip the script, paying healthcare teams to keep people healthy and not just treat illness. The results, they say, better outcomes, less waste and closer teamwork. But without a change in how funders pay for care, could the transformation that we're going to talk about actually stall? I'm in conversation from value-based healthcare with Lungile Kasapato. Lungile, a very warm welcome. So maybe let's just start with a little bit of context and explanation here. Why do you think South Africa has clung to a free-for-service or a fee-for-service model for so long when there is ample evidence that it drives up costs and often fragments care?
The reason why we have clung for service for such a long time and there is a big reluctance for South Africa to move is that all the structures in our healthcare system have been built around healthcare, around fee for service. So the way that we pay for everything and, you know, the whole structure basically is built around that. It will take a lot of courage for the change to happen. But also it will take some investment to happen, because if you are going to change the structure, you are going to have to invest in new ways of supporting value-based healthcare as opposed to the current one. So those are the main ones. The structure has been built for fee-for-service, and all the industries and businesses that we've built around the system work around that. So it's going to take somebody who understands, and most people do understand and acknowledge that value-based healthcare is the way to go. But it's going to take some investment. It's going to be a bit expensive to start off, but it will pay off in due time.
So you use the word courage. How do you overcome resistance then from hospitals and specialists whose revenue depends on high service volumes?
Yes, you need courage. But I think we need to start looking at this not as a threat for the system, because all indications based by the Health Market Inquiry report suggest that the current status quo is about to collapse. In fact, the private healthcare market is already in failure. We are not collecting as much as we are spending. And if that doesn't change, the whole system may very well collapse. And that's a reality. So if we understand that and we come to a realization and an acknowledgement of that and stop almost burying our hands in the sand, you know, as we always say, and face this head on and say, what can we do to start shifting from the current system to the new system? So it's us realizing that going ahead the way that we are doing now is only going to lead to a slippery road downhill. And that, so we have to change.
That's quite an assertion that you're making. What evidence do you have that the system is actually going to collapse within its current paradigm?
So I'm actually not making these assertions. If you go and have a look at the Health Market Inquiry, which was commissioned by the government and took it was conducted by the commission, the Competition Commission, took more than 5 years, came up with a report. I think it's about 500 pages. All the suggestions and all the evidence leads to that. The current system is totally unsustainable.
So
these are not just my assertions.
Fair enough. So your model rewards keeping patients healthy. Is there hard data that it actually proves and proves that it works better than the current system?
Yes, there is. So the model has been implemented in many countries, and the evidence is proving that it does result in better outcomes. In South Africa, ourselves as PPOSEV started playing around and experimenting with the model for quite some time. We're now 10 years old, but one of our biggest pilots that we conducted was a pilot that we conducted with GEMS. It was conducted over a period of 3 years. And over that period, the results showed that there was a 29% reduction in hospitalization. There was 29% reduction in hospitalization. There was 39% increase in uptake of flu vaccines. And there was a 5% increase in disease management. So, yes, there is hard evidence, and it has been piloted and proven here in South Africa as well.
So, Lungile, let me suggest to you that the model might risk cherry-picking healthier patients to boost outcomes. How do you guard against that happening?
Yeah, that's a very a great question. Thank you for asking that. So the system guards against that by ensuring that the patients allocated to a specific provider, not based on how sick they are. So a provider is actually allocated patients that were already traditionally seeing that that provider based on claims data. And all of the patients, regardless of how sick they are and or of how healthy they are allocated to that provider. And then we support the provider, and then the provider walks the journey with the patients. Then we look at the outcomes, and the outcomes will take into consideration how sick the patient is. So it's not like you expect a patient that has got three chronic diseases never to ever be admitted. But we say a patient that's got three chronic diseases, as an example, would be admitted maybe for a month in a year. But with the program and the support that we give to the patient as well as the provider, we can be able to actually reduce that from a month to maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks, just as an example.
Just a quick answer, please. If medical schemes are serious about reform, I have to ask you why they aren't already funding care in this way.
Again, Jeremy, it's a radical change from the current status quo. One, we don't have maybe enough expertise, we don't have enough experience in this model. So there is some hesitation, which is why even the current contract that we have with GEMS had to be pilot for 3 years. So we need the schemes need to immerse themselves in the data and maybe look at the pilots that have been run, like the pilots that we have run, and then satisfy themselves.
Thank you very much indeed. It certainly is an interesting concept. Lungile Kasapato from Value Based Healthcare, I appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.